How's that old parting line go? I'll see you in the funny papers. It was just a line for most of us, but for today's guest, it's true. You can see the work of Francesco Marciuliano in the funny papers. He is the writer of the strip Sally Forth, now appearing in hundreds of newspapers around the world, and he struck gold with books of poetry by our pets. I Could Pee on This, poetry ostensibly by cats, made the New York Times bestseller list. Its companion is now on sale. It's called I Could Chew on This and Other Poems by Dogs. Francesco Marciuliano, in addition to all the other things he does, writes a webcomic called Medium Large and was the head writer for the PBS children's series Seymour's Playhouse. He lives in New York and he's our guest. Francesco, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Do you prefer chess as the form of address? Francesco, not a chess?
Chess is fine as well. Chess, Francesco. Well, all I can say is you pronounce my last name spectacularly, so after that, you can call me what you want.
Thanks. Glad to get that right. Got to get those C-I's and C-E's correct in Italian.
It's like 48 vowels and a consonant in the middle. It's a mess.
Is writing the common thread, I mean, obviously it is the common thread in all you do, so how do you introduce yourself, for example, at cocktail parties?
Poorly, because I'm a somewhat shy person, so I always mess up the introduction.
But
I basically just say I'm a writer, and then they assume, oh, he's unemployed, and we work from there, you know.
So what were your dreams and ambitions as a kid? What did you want to do when you grow up?
Oddly enough, I mean, it's not like I was five and here's my bucket list, because that would be a little morbid, but I mean, basically, my goal was I wanted to have a comic strip, I wanted to write humor books, and oddly enough, I did want to write for puppets. So outside of Jedi Academy, I think I pretty much hit all my career goals I made at age eight, which means I don't know what to do with the rest of my life, but you know, for now, it's been fine.
I guess that brings us back to the other part of the question. What do you want to do when you grow up? Have you grown up?
Depends who you ask. I can pay my own bills. Let's put it that way.
Okay, well, I'll take that as
I'm grown up in my own fashion. We'll put it that way.
When did you begin channeling cats and dogs? And once you did, were books of poetry inevitable?
The poems themselves came about, I had two cats. I had Boris and Natasha, who the first book is dedicated to, for about 17 years. I had them shortly after college. And when they passed away, there was about a three-year difference between the two. I felt very sad. I missed them greatly. And I wanted to think about them, but I wanted to think about them in a very happy way. Because, you know, one, to get through a mourning process. Two, because when I thought about my cats, they were always happy thoughts. And that actually gave birth to the cat poems. And I started writing those, and I posted some online, and I got a good reaction. And then I gave it to my agent, and he got a good reaction. And, the whole point is I wanted them to be humorous. I wanted them to be very much about from the pet's point of view. But I also didn't want to be cutesy, because I think a lot of times you can go into a very saccharine kind of view. And I don't think that would have done service to the cats. I think, you know, they can be cute. They can be maddening. They can be, you know, they have very rich personalities. And the same thing with the dog. I grew up with several dogs. And it's basically my way of just remembering all the pets, which, considering I've had turtles, fish, and canaries, may be a warning to readers in the future. I don't know.
So we know what the next sets of books might be.
But if you voles and hedgehogs for British gardeners, yeah, we're just going to write it out.
Well, it seems you're making an important distinction here, though, Chess, because you tried not to make it cutesy. You said you weren't trying to make greeting cards here. You're actually trying to make what could potentially be real thoughts of your pets.
Right. No, I wanted to. What I would think is certain scenarios. I think a lot of times when we think about our pets, we think about what the pet gives to us, what the pet gives to their person. But I think also you have to realize what the pet is thinking at the other side of the relationship. And that was with the cat book, and that's even more so with the dog book, because it's very having a dog as a pet is very much about that bonding experience. So it's very much the other way around. What they're getting out of it, what they're missing when you're not there, what they are with other dogs, especially at dog parks or maybe another dog you have in a house, and what they're thinking on their own. So a lot of this was the time the pet is by him or herself, or with the cats. You know, you see the cat just staring into the distance for 8 hours, which doesn't seem to explain how much I did with my time at that point, as I'm staring at a cat staring at nothing for 8 hours. But it really is the thought of what is going through the cat's mind. They're just not shutting off. And with a dog, what is going through their mind when you're not there? And even when you are there, what are they thinking?
How big a surprise, then, was the success of I Could Pee on This?
I still remain startled, I would say. At no point has this been, that thing, okay, that's fine. No, I consider myself very fortunate. I thank all the readers. I thank all the stores. I thank all the independent bookstores, which have been fantastic for this book and for I Could Chew on This. I'm very lucky. So I continue to be happily startled. So I guess that'll be the best way I can put it.
Had you already written the poems for I Could Chew on This by the time that I Could Pee on This was published?
The poems for I Could Chew on This were finished actually before I Could Pee on This came out. And the Chronicle book seemed very happy with the cat poems, so they wanted to start moving on the dog poems. Just that way there wouldn't be this 2 or 3 year gap. And, they were very happy with it, and that was certainly a good sign on my end, so I was more than happy to write the dog poem book.
There are so many ways you could go with the kinds of things that dogs or cats might think. Was it hard to limit yourself a little bit to basic ideas for what they could write about?
Yeah, I mean, each book, I think, is about 60 poems. For each of them, I would say I wrote about 150, 160. And then I winnowed down. So there are a lot of other poems. Some of them appear for the cat poems. Some of them appear in the current, there's an I Could Pee on This calendar. It's funny that you mentioned you didn't want to write greeting cards. So in the spring, there are some I Could Pee on This greeting cards.
Oh, my God.
And
got
there
the
are
dark
a few
side.
Calendars down the line, and now I'm just driving everyone nuts. I'm getting to the point where people say, just stop. But, there were several poems, and then it was a matter of finding the ones that work together and finding the ones that work within the subject matter, because each book is broken up into 4 chapters, and what works best within the context of those chapters.
Stay tuned to the Jefferson Exchange for more of our conversation with Francesco Marciuliano and Jeffrey Riley hosting. We'll be back after a short break.
And Chassie, we're just talking about the chapters in the books. And for I Could Chew on This, we have Inside, Outside, By Your Side, and Heavy Thinking. And would you mind, just to give people an idea of what's in here, reading I Lose My Mind When You Leave the House?
Of course. This is where I flip to that page. So I play my own hold music. There we go. No, it always ends up being the girl from Ipanema, and then I've got that in my head for 2 days.
And now you shared
it
with...
Once that's in, it's there forever.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is I Lose My Mind When You Leave the House. The plants are torn, the garbage strewn, the wires chewed, the couch and I had a fight. Your bed is soaked, your liquor spilled, your TV smashed, your laptop no longer has any valves. There's a smartphone in the toaster, there's a toaster in the toilet, there's a toilet in the hallway, there's underwear in my mouth. I went places I should never go. I saw a side of myself I should never see. I said things to the cat I can never take back, so please, don't ever leave again.
The poem is I Lose My Mind When You Leave the House, a part of the collection I Could Chew on This by Francesco Marciuliano. I read that out loud in front of a couple of adults the other night, and they were screaming in laughter.
Oh, thank you very much.
I have to wonder, though, that's the second reference in the book that I noticed as I read the poem Hoarding. It was the one that had the second reference to underpants in the mouth. Does that happen much around your house?
It did happen with my dogs. For some reason, they would get clothes. And, I don't know why. I mean, it was at a laundry basket. They weren't, like, rifling through drawers or anything. Then it would get a little weird. But, you know, you leave a laundry basket, and for some reason that would be the first thing. Maybe they were just happy when it was just the pile of whites or something like that, and they would go there. Socks were a big thing, or at least one sock, you know, just to ruin the pair. But, clothes, they're fascinating clothes. Dogs would steal the clothes. Cats would sleep in them. You know, they're just fascinated by nice, clean laundry.
They really are. It's a real benefit to being an animal that size to get to crash on your owner's underwear or have fun with it anyway.
Apparently, that's one of the perks.
I want to get to another poem here on page 18, Dance of Joy. because this really gets into the rhythm of the excited dog. I think you convey what dogs might be thinking pretty well here.
But yeah, and this would be, this is from when I was growing up, my dog Panda, who the book is dedicated to. And she was very sweet and very even-tempered, but when it came to food, you were just like, we're going to get this, we're going to do this now, right? So this is Dance of Joy. This is the dance I do for you, this is the dance I do for you as you get my can of food. This is the twirl I do for you, this is the twirl I do for you as you open my can of food. This is the leap I do for you, this is the 8-foot vertical leap I do for you as you stop serving my food to answer the phone. This is me running in a sheer panic, wild panic. This is me running in a desperate, gasping, blind panic as you continue to talk on the phone. This is me losing my censored mind. This is my censored brains, my censored cool. This is me wondering what the bleep could be bleep. Important that you're still on the bleep phone. This is me realizing I was howling out loud, really loud, and that perhaps I overreacted just a little. And so this is me eating the food you give to me, always give to me.
Dance of Joy by Francesco Marciuliano from I Could Chew on This and Other Poems by Dogs. How long did it take to compile the ones just in this book?
It was several months, and I wrote poems by I live in New York City, and I tend to write a lot by walking. I walk about 6 to 8 miles a day, and that's how I do most of my walking. And even in the city with all the sound stuff, once you're focused, you can shut out a lot of sound. And it was just reflecting on animals, and of course, living in Manhattan, there are a lot of dog parks, and you see a lot of dogs, and you see them interact with the owners, and you see them interact with each other, and some poems are just walking by. Like in New York, you will see a lot of dogs tied outside as the owner is in the store. So one of the poems gave birth to what goes through a dog's mind, why they're alone outside. Because dogs, as you know from the I Lose My Mind, don't have the greatest sense of time. So they don't know if the owner's been in there for 15 minutes, an hour and a half since last March, and it's just... You know, they're just trying to figure out and just trying to make do and trying to start a conversation with the nearby fire hydrant, you know. So that's kind of it, but it's a lot of just reflecting on the dogs I had and also observing other animals. There, you know, this is what I do as an adult.
Which is a pretty good gig. And
there are worse ways to earn a living, yes. I'll grant you that.
But now you have Sally Forth going on at the same time. You have to write this daily strip for the funny papers, and you're not the originator of the strip. How did you get into that with Greg Howard?
I actually only spoke to Greg Howard once over the phone. What had happened is that Greg Howard was ending his relationship with the strip, and he was selling his half back to the syndicate. And at the time, I had submitted a comic strip about a couple, because, you know, there aren't enough of those in the Sunday papers. But I had submitted a strip about a couple, and Jay Kennedy, the editor at the time, really liked the strip. So he called me up, and the first thing he said, I really like your strip. We're not going to syndicate it. And I thought, oh, Lord, he's bored, and now he's just calling people to say no. But he said, would you like to do the strip Sally Forth? And I think I said yes between the words Sally and Forth. But I had not grown up with Sally Forth. I did not run in New York, so they sent me 9 years of strips, and this would be back in 1997 when you couldn't do that over email. So I got this giant package of 9 years' worth of Sally Forth strips, which I devoured. And I've been writing it for about 16 years now, and I love every minute of it. The strip has changed greatly, I think. But I consider the characters, you know, without being possessive, but I do consider the characters part of my family now, so I know it's been a long time since I felt like I was writing someone else's strip. I really feel bonded with the comic.
And who are the main figures in the strip? There's Sally, certainly, and her husband, and a daughter.
There's husband, Ted, there's Hillary, and then there's a whole bunch of ancillary characters. There's Sally's mom and Sally's sister and all the relationships there, her ex-boss, Ralph, Hillary's friends, Faye and Nona. The cast has gotten quite large since I've taken over, and it's fun to explore all their worlds and how they interact with one another.
I have to wonder, particularly about Sally, and then she reminds me, not in intellect, but in some other ways, of Blondie, but it seems like the main characters in strips are often fated to stand by while weirder people drive the action.
That does happen to a degree. I mean, you know, in the case of Blondie, it would basically be, why isn't this strip called Dagwood? But in this case, I think the best analogy I can take is, in no way am I saying comparing it to the level of achievement or anything, but Mary Tyler Moore with the Mary Tyler Moore Show from the 70s, where the main character is Mary Tyler Moore, but she's the center of sane in a slightly world of kind of wacky people. And I think that's, you know, that was the idea of Cheers initially. Shelley Long's character, Diane, was the center sane, but she slowly lost her mind the longer she stayed in the bar. But, yeah, I think that does happen. We're the main character. We're the avatar for the reader. They see the world through that character, so that character has to be a little more grounded. But what I used to get were some complaints early on. I was like, why does Sally have to be so perfect? Which was the concept of the strip. When it first came out in 1983, the concept was, you have to prove to people that someone could be a mom and also have a career. Now, if that were the premise of the strip now, it would be like it's Caught in Amber from 1983.
Right.
You know, that would be a silly premise. Unfortunately, in 1983, 1982, you actually had to prove that to people. But the premise now, so the idea was like she had to be perfect, but now that doesn't make sense anymore. And people go, why does she have to be so perfect? I thought, why does she have to be so perfect? And that gave birth to the mom who was always questioning, and the sister who really needed her but resented needing her. And so that gave birth to various other characters, and I liked exploring the concept. So I think Sally, while she's the normal character and all, I've managed to show the reasons behind why she has to be normal. And sometimes she doesn't hold it together as well as she used to, because it can be straining.
It is funny watching Sally erupt, because it doesn't happen terribly often. She does tend to be the calm center. But
And when it happens, you know, a lot took her to get to there. You know, and it's almost like that's a well-deserved, you know, freak out right there.
It is indeed. Francesco Marciuliano is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He is the writer of the Sally Forth comic strip in 800 newspapers around the world. Not quite 800. He's also the author of the book I Could Chew on This and Other Poems by Dogs, which is the follow-up to I Could Pee on This and Poems by Cats.
This is a version of the exchange from our archives. It is pre-recorded, so we're not giving out the phone number and the email address today because we can't take any new phone calls or emails today. Thanks.
So when you're taking over a strip from a creator, in this case Greg Howard, who created Sally Forth, 15 years before you got a hold of it,
right.
Any admonitions from him or from the editor about things not to do with the characters?
I spoke mostly with the editor at the time, who was Jay Kenney at the time, and now it's Brendan Burford. But, Greg Howard, I had one conversation. I think he really just wanted to leave the strip, so, you know, he wished me luck, and it was a certainly pleasant conversation, but there was no hand-holding through the process. And it was more on the editor's side, and the initial concept was status quo. Maintain the strip as it was. Which is why I think my first 2 years writing the strip were not very good. Because it's sort of like, it happens. You'll see some strips, and I'm not naming strips, and I don't mean to do the other thing, but when it's left in someone else's hands, it can kind of become an echo of itself. And the one thing I realized after a while is, like, if this strip is going to last, I'm going to have to make some changes that seem a little more my sense of humor or my take on things, because I can't keep doing an imitation. So I slowly started making chances, and then the Ted character became a little different, and then Hillary grew up a little. The characters have actually, I would say in the last 15 years, they've probably all aged about 4 years. Hillary was about 8 when she started. She's 12 now, which means, you know, in another 80 years, maybe she'll graduate high school. But changes did have to be made, I think, for the strip to survive. And as I said before, when the strip came out, it was very much, ooh, working woman, isn't that a novel concept? If that was the concept of the strip now, it might as well not exist.
But you hit on a major point that we need to ask about, which is the slow arc of the characters in a strip like this. I mean, Luann, for example, in her strip is just now a senior in high school after, 35, 40 years. and so it must be somewhat agonizing for you as a writer to you just want to put Hillary in a car once in a while and have her drive down to the grocery store or something.
You know, just to get your motor running, she rides off on a motorcycle. It does do so. I mean, you can explore a lot when there's a certain age group. What had happened is that she was 8 years old, and I was working with 8 years old, and she was in pigtails. You know, she had the Cindy Brady look initially. And then after a while, I just realized I can't keep writing for an 8-year-old because there are a lot of stories one's missing out on. And I had this story once where she didn't like her look. She was no longer popular. She was a very normal kid. She was like, she was good at school, and she played softball, and she was a normal kid. And at one point, I wanted her to get a little artsier, and I wanted her, suddenly she moved into the next grade, and she was no longer popular, and she didn't have these friends. So she pulled out her pigtails and tried to go long hair. She dressed in black a little bit for a little while, you know, that standard thing. And she met her best friend, Faye, and then slowly things evolved there. That's why the characters of Sally and Ted were probably about 36 when I started. I'd say now they're about 42, maybe 43, and I was kind of aging them slowly to where I was so I could have the reference points. There's a point now that I'm going to age past them, and I have to. Otherwise, you know, why, you know, why, as they get older and their daughter's still 12. But, it did, so that's why things change. That's why their age change. Hillary's now 12. For me to move Hillary into 13, there's something significant between the age of 12, at least theoretically, 12 to 13. So it may take a little while for that, because then she will become a much different character.
And Chess, how do you coordinate with the artist? It's Craig McIntosh, right?
Craig McIntosh retired in December.
Uh-huh.
And he helped someone, he basically brought someone in. So the new artist is Jim Keefe, who previously did the illustrations for the Flash Gordon comic strip.
Oh.
And I worked with Craig for several years. Craig was one of the most professional, one of the nicest guys you ever meet. Jim Keefe is absolutely fantastic. He's funny. We get along very well. I've been very fortunate, and it's all email. I spoke to Craig. We had a fantastic working relationship for 15 years. I spoke to Craig maybe 3 times.
Wow.
Over the phone. But the rest of it was email, and we just worked well. And Jim Keefe, we talk by email. We also talk now more on Twitter and Facebook and such. But I have yet to meet him. I actually never met Craig.
So how do you get communicated with your artist things like facial expressions and I want them lying on the ground looking at the clouds or, you know, any of that, those sorts of things that really will make a difference in the ultimate impact of a daily strip?
Yeah, and that's a very good question. What it is, each week and each Sunday, the scripts are written like scripts. They're each day is broken to 3 panels. There is the dialogue, which uses the official Sally Forth font. And then there's the scene description. And in that scene description, I write out, it's like a little playlet. I'm not saying, oh, these are plays, but I'm just saying it's a little playlet for each scene. I write out what they're doing. And Greg Howard had created this template much earlier with Craig McIntosh for facial numbers. Number 3 is the normal face. Number 13.5 is what was the smirk face, which I don't use anymore. I wasn't a fan of the smirk face. I don't like characters who seem to be very happy with their own punchline. Number 2 was happy. Number 4 is annoyed. And I've used that for a while, but over time, I've wanted to be a little more expressive with the character. So I start saying, this eyebrow is arched. This character's a little upset. And I like having the artist also have a little more freedom how they want to portray that. But I write the scene description. I write where they are in the panel. I write what they're going on, what their position thing. But, you know, the artist is certainly free to make their interpretation as well. That's I'm setting it up, and then it's the artist can also do what they want. I don't mean to be like, it's this or nothing.
Right. And the editor gets the final call then?
The editor gets final call. I have not had any changes for about 10 years, except for one point, which I'll tell you right now. There was, this was early on, I think Hillary was maybe 10 at the time, and she and her friend had, she was at her friend's house, and they played a video game that they shouldn't have been playing. You know, a rated M video game, Sort of a Grand Theft Auto kind of deal. And I wanted to come up with a title that sounded like a video game. The moment you hear the title, it's like, oh, they shouldn't be playing that. And the title was The Knifing on Knife Hill Knifers Edition. And my editor, Brendan, calls up, and he just starts laughing. He's like, there was no way in hell that was ever going to see daylight. And I said, I know, and I forgot what I had to come to. And it was like one or two other instances where I tried to go and say, no, I mean, good, you know, nice that you tried that, but that's never going to see print.
That was the Knifers on Knifing Hill Knifers Edition?
Yeah, it's the Knifing on Knifers Hill, the Knifing on Knife Hill Knifers Edition. I just wanted that title that right away said, no kid should be playing this game. And apparently I hit it a little too much on the nose.
All right, let's take a call from Mike in Eagle Point. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Francesco Marciuliano, the writer of the Sally Forth comic strip.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Hi.
I'm an aging baby boomer who does enjoy sitting down with the comics with my first cup of coffee in the morning. Oh. And it's becoming more and more difficult to get a copy of our more or less statewide newspaper, The Oregonian. And I'm wondering how your guest views the future of the comics page as less and less is available on print and more we're having to rely on the internet. It's sitting down with a laptop is just not the same experience.
All right. Thanks for that, Mike. Appreciate it.
I think that's actually, Mike, that's actually a very good question, and it is sad, actually. I grew up on Long Island, which is why I sound like this, listeners. But, and I remember the Daily News and Newsday, the comics would still take a full page. The back was Peanuts. I remember the front page of the Daily News was Annie, Blondie. Each comic either got half a page or a full page, and it was just this fantastic thing to actually have to wait to that day, to wait to get the paper, to read it, to sit down, and I do miss that. And I love web comics. I write a web comic. I enjoy web comics. But when I get anthologies of web comics, I buy the book. I like having print, and I think I'm hoping that doesn't get lost, because I think that's a valuable part of the comic experience.
Much more to talk about with Francesco Marciuliano and Jeffrey Riley interviewing here on the Jefferson Exchange. Francesco, of course, the artist behind Sally Forth and the writer behind several best-selling books. The one we're discussing today is I Could Chew on This, talking about poetry allegedly written by dogs. Just a reminder, we're not taking phone calls and emails for this segment because it is pre-recorded. However, we'd love for you to stick with us. We'll be back with Francesco Marciuliano after a short break here on the Jefferson Exchange. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. We are running with a skeletal staff due to the holiday, which is a great opportunity to dip into the archives. Some great gold over the last few years. This one is one of Jeffrey Riley's favorites. It comes from September of 2013, in conversation with Francesco Marciuliano, the artist behind the comic strip Sally Forth, talking about his book, I Could Chew on This, imagining what it would be like if dogs could write poems. We're going to get back into that now. Reminder, we can't take your phone calls and emails because we don't have a time machine. Here is Francesco and Jeffrey.
Chess, I suspected you were from Long Island because Ted Forth in particular keeps talking about his Long Island experiences.
Right.
I lived in Levittown until I was 13. Where are you from?
From Dix Hills.
Okay. My cousin lives in Dix Hills.
Oh, really? Yeah. This is a small world.
It is indeed. I remember the story about Dix Hills and how the Long Island Expressway had to make a zigzag around a farm thanks to Robert Moses, but...
That's right.
Getting the Long Island history in a hurry here. But so the power that you have over your characters, like you can make Ted Forth from Long Island because it's what you know. Is there ever a sense of godlike glee that you have to fight off? Like, I'm going to make Ralph happy and Sally very unhappy in one move.
You know, a lot of tenting of Mr. Burns, tenting of fingers.
Exactly. Right.
And just, you know, yelling at the laptop, I own you. And it's like, no. I mean, I'm allowed a great deal of freedom, which the moment I said that, if the editors are listening, I was like, we got to clamp down on this now. But, Ted, for better and for worse, has become somewhat my avatar in the strip. And so if you were asking the question earlier about whether or not I'm an adult, look at Ted and there'll be your answer. But that's why Ted's Gen X fascination with pop culture and such. But, you know, I've been writing the characters for a while, and I think I've changed them, hopefully for the better. I've made them fuller. Not that there was ever anything wrong with Greg Howard's strip at all. It's just a different strip, I think. And it's at the point where if I come up with a storyline, I can kind of see how the characters would react to it. And that's what actually makes me happier. It isn't simply like I can put a friend's name in the strip, which I do. King Features, you did not hear that. But, you know, Sally's boss is actually named after a friend of mine, and there are various other friends' names that I put in. But the Ted character, I was happy to do that because I think it gave a certain amount of specific... Blah, blah, blah. I'm going to ruin that word, so we'll just move on to another one. I'm going to... it grounded Ted in a way. I think when you get into specifics, it helps comedy and it helps the character. I know a lot about Long Island growing up. It was very much about his family, so I was very happy to do that. I only have one brother. I don't have four brothers. And so I had a flashback, like this fantasy story, where what if they didn't meet? And you got to find out Sally's last name was Jensen beforehand, and you got to find out what she was doing. And I've done flashbacks to how they met in college and how they got engaged and when they bought their house and when, you know, Hillary was born. And I like this. I like filling in the pieces. So it really isn't so much a godlike power, but very much I like creating this world, and I like making it richer, and I like making it more defined.
And it has been fun to watch some of that stuff. I mean, watching how Ted and Sally met and seeing what they were like in college, and, of course, the bigger hair and things like that was
right.
Was
you know, touch. I got to have Ted wear a Sonic Youth T-shirt, which maybe wouldn't have happened in the strip before, but, you know, it made me happy.
In this age of the Internet and instant fan feedback and often harsh anonymous feedback, what do you hear from people about the strip?
I get both. I get people who are very happy with the strip. I get people who sometimes they didn't like the changes in the strip. They don't like the changes, you know. And my approach has been, you know, everyone who really, you can't go with the fact that everyone who really likes the strip is right and everyone who doesn't like what you're doing is wrong. You can't do that. And I think you have to remember that when you do something, when you put out a book, when you put out a comic strip, after that, in some way, it's no longer yours. It belongs to the reader, and their opinion, however they're going, is valid to them. And you have to accept that, and you have to agree, be okay with that. You have to agree once it's out there, it kind of belongs to the reader as well. I mean, not legally. You know, Hearst Magazine will sue anyone who decides to whatever to do with strip. But, you know, you have to accept that, and that's somewhat freeing. And whenever I get a harsher criticism, I write back to everybody, and I say, you know, and I sincerely thank them for reading the strip, because, you know, they're not paid to read the strip. They don't have to read the strip, and if they read the strip and took the time to say what they thought was the problem with the strip, I have to acknowledge that, and I have to, in some way, thank them for that. They took their time. They put an effort to do that, and the same with people who write to say thank you. I'm very happy to that as well. I mean, glad, obviously, I enjoy those emails more, but, and I also tried to have an Internet presence. I didn't want to be one of the cartoonists, I can't say there are others, a cartoonist who shrinks away or doesn't want to have any interaction with readers whatsoever. In medium large, I've made fun of Sally Forth. You have to be okay with yourself. You have to be able to laugh at yourself. You have to be able to, you know, whenever I do satire and strip, I satirize things I love, because if you satirize things you don't like, the humor gets curdled and mean-spirited, and I don't like that kind of humor. So I'll satirize Sally Forth because I love Sally Forth, but I also know there can be issues with it, and there's things you can have fun with it. And so if I know that and I'm okay with that, I have to be okay with other people doing it. And you can't be thin-skinned, and you have to realize in the end, it's like I have a career writing characters 3 panels a day. I do something I absolutely love. And that, if I can't be okay with other people going, I don't like it, I don't deserve to do the strip. I'm very fortunate, and I keep that in mind every day.
Wow, that's very adult of you.
See, sometimes I can be an adult. Sometimes I pull it off.
You have the other strip, the webcomic, Medium Large. Tell us a bit about that. Is it all you from end to end?
Yeah, that I write, that I draw. I've been doing it, there was a pause, but I did it since about 2005. And a lot of that is very pop culture oriented, or obviously more Gen X, but, you know, it's gotten Gen Y, millennial, and we just keep moving forward. But, yeah, I mean, that basically is whatever I want to say. It's a different humor kind of way. You know, there's humor in that strip that would not see the light of day in Sally Forth in a way. But on the other hand, writing Medium Large when I started, actually about 2004, started doing that, also altered the way I started writing Sally Forth, because I started doing what was really my sense of humor, and people liked it, and I said, well, people do like it, maybe I could slip in a little in Sally Forth, and that became sort of the period when I started creating new strips, new characters in Sally Forth, and started feeling more like, I think this is my strip. You know, I did it for several years, and I was happy, but at that point, that's when I began to realize, I actually think this is my strip, and I just... writing the webcomic made me enjoy writing Sally Forth all the more.
And we haven't even talked about one of the other things you had been doing over the years, which is working on Seymour's Playhouse, Seymour Seal and other puppets with safety messages. How'd you get that gig?
I actually got it through King Features. They were looking for writers for King Features was one of the co-producers, and they asked for writers, you know, who do you think would be a good writer? And Jay said, well, you know, Ched's, you know, he liked me a lot. And he said, you know, he's a very good writer, and he's got a silly side to him. You know, read Immature. But, you know, do this. And that was the first script I ever wrote when I wrote I just wrote an episode as a trial run. I had written scripts, but that was like the first one professionally I had done. And I lucked out because that was the script that won two regional Emmys. And I was very happy about that. And then I started writing more. By the second season, I think, you know, there were like 15 episodes, and I might have written about 12 of them. And, you know, like all PBS shows, funding becomes a problem sometimes, and that's why the show went off the air. But I had a blast, and I got to go see them film the show, got to do the puppets, and once again, this was a career goal. I wanted to write for puppets, right. Which sounds a little worrisome when you say at age 5, I want to write for puppets. Oh, dear Lord, he's going to be a liberal arts major. Which then, unfortunately, that all proved to be true. Right. But, you know, it can work out, people. That's what I'm saying. It can work out.
Hold on to your dreams.
Hold on to your bad little dreams.
Right. Did you get to write the songs, too?
Initially, I did write songs. I'm not a songwriter, so I would write songs, but I'd write them in. I was happy, and in a way, that was the start of trying to write the poems as well. Because that was the first time I, you know, songs without the music, you know, lyrics do have a poem structure to them, poetic structure to them. And that actually helped. And then they decided second season, maybe we should hire a professional musician. Because while I could write the lyrics, I don't have really the sense of tune going in my head. But, you know, the poetry allowed me to do that without worrying of, you know, when does the, you know, when does the guitar kick in?
So I'm struck by the fact that the range of stuff you write from the dog getting into expletive deleted language about the food coming late to learning how to take care of your bicycle tires with Seymour's Playhouse, that you really get a chance to write for the id, the ego, and the superego.
Let's just say I lucked out. I wrote for the Onion News Network for a couple years, and that was a different kind of thing. I've done some stuff for McSweeney's. And, I've been, as I said, I do get to do a lot of different humor, and I know I'm lucky and I do that. And, you know, I don't get to do the thing where, like, well, you know, people know me as this, but I really always wanted to do that. And I've been very fortunate to have a chance, you know, for better, for worse, whatever the reaction has been. I've been fortunate that the opportunities have come about that I could kind of flex all these different, you know, creative impulses.
All right. I want to talk a bit more about I Could Chew on this. We'll get into the poems in a second. But making Jeannie wait almost all morning. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, holy cow. I thought it was God, thank you so much. And thank you, Kaz, for giving pets a voice. You know, when Jeffrey, you read those two poems, I was laughing through the tears. I wish more people understood that. And right then, my cat's brushing against me with her raccoon tail. You already had tuna albacore. Get out of here. Thank you so much. And I will look forward to discovering your comic strip, Sally Forth.
All right. Thanks for that, Jeannie.
That is so sweet. Thank you very much. Thank you. I'm very happy you enjoyed the poem. Thank you.
Let us turn to page 66 and go to Wingman. I really want to have the audience hear this one from I Could Chew on This and Other Poems by Dogs.
I will say in the book, what I love about Wingman is the photo they chose. Because they just chose, I won't say too, but it's just this crestfallen expression on this poor dog. And it's just when I looked at it, I laughed for like half an hour. I was like, that's what it would be.
Right.
That poor dog. So this poem is Wingman. I wag my tail, I tilt my head, I give a little wink. I flash my smile, I show my belly, I give a little lick. I do it all from sit to speak to attract women far and near. Then you chime in with something about fan fiction. And I realize we're going to die alone. And, you know, if I were in a dog park and I was saying the time, I'm pretty sure that's how I'd mess it up. And I think when I've been with dogs and walking around, whatever I say, I know every so often the dog just stops and looks. It's like, you know, we can part right now. I know my way home.
And it's funny because we had a discussion about on a much more serious level about the ways that we are not necessarily always ourselves in social situations. But when you're around a dog, it's like, hi, who's a good boy? And you just talk to the dog in ways that you wouldn't talk to another human being. So here we were having this fairly serious psychological discussion last week, and here comes along Wingman that just puts it all in a few short lines.
Oh, thank you. No, and it's we are freer, I think, around our animals. And I think even when we're in public, we're still free in the way we communicate. And I think that's part of the joy. We can really be around, especially with dogs, because, you know, we always think, you know, dogs are happy with us no matter who we are. They're not judging us. They may very well, and I obviously think they do occasionally look at you as like, okay, I think I'm going to go sit over there now. Whereas, you know, cats, whenever you do that, the cat is staring at you. What is the cat thinking? Is the cat judging me? I've just kind of explained my inner deepest thoughts. Is the cat going to charge me for this therapy session? But, no, and I think that is part of the beauty of having a pet, or, you know, being with a pet, is that freeing moment that you do get these moments of pure joy and pure relaxation, and just it's a relationship unlike any other.
Let us finish the round of poems with Hello on page 102 of I Could Chew on This. Francesco Marciuliano, our guest on The Exchange.
And I did mark that page, so we're all good. So we don't have to do the hold music or whatever would be my equivalent of hold music. So this is Hello. I'm sorry he's out of breath. I'm sorry he's in such distress. I'm sorry he's in a fetal position, sobbing on the floor. But you know, if I could, I most certainly would give a heads up by yelling, "Crotch!" before greeting your date full speed at the door. And that would happen with me with my dog. It's just moment, "Hey, pet!" Whoop! And then 5 minutes disappear as the world slowly starts to piece itself together again.
"I'm so glad to see you." Bam! Yeah, and then down you go.
It's like, and then it's like, "Wake up. Is it still Tuesday? I don't know what happened."
I have to believe that this is such a rich vein that are you like on the verge of printing the sequel to I Could Pee on This already, the cat book?
There is a sequel coming out next year.
One
so like
dogs.
I said, I will keep doing this until people scream at me.
I don't think anybody's going to scream at you anytime soon. Francesco Marciuliano, our guest, his book is I Could Chew on This and Other Poems by Dogs. It's the follow-up to I Could Pee on This, the book of cat poems. And, of course, he is the writer for the Sally Forth comic strip. Chess, pleasure to get to know you in person.
It's been fantastic. Thank you. I've had a great time.